If you think about the type of data that you want to collect, if your singular mindset is, I want to have the most data to create the best AI, then what are you going to do? You're going to create a platform that captures as much data as it possibly can. But that comes at a cost. The cost is engagement. So every single platform on the planet has an engagement problem. And I don't want to sound crass, but people who are suffering from diabetes and obesity and metabolic dysfunction, somewhere in the root causes is an engagement problem.
Welcome back for part two of our conversation with Ali Hashemi, a highly successful serial entrepreneur in Dubai who has built GlueCare, one of the most effective diabetic patient management systems anywhere. So thanks to a unique integration of digital technology and human touch, they've cracked the code on behavioral change as a way to tackle chronic diseases. We will not only learn very powerful insights in how to implement technology, and in particular, the role of AI, but we'll also get into some depth about why Dubai is such a unique ecosystem in which to build a healthcare startup. All right, in part one, we learned about the genesis of GlueCare, his company. We talked about its outcomes in glucose management, which basically blow away the competition, and probably do so because they reimagined the experience from the point of view of the patient. Today, we'll hear more about how they leverage their data to make their providers feel superhuman and how to go at risk with payers and also their business model. So many great insights to be learned from Ali as he builds a company tackling chronic diseases in Dubai with a vision to take this around the world. So let's get back to Ali at an outdoor cafe on the boardwalk of one of Dubai's many yacht-laden marinas.
So when we started building GlueCare, look, I'm not a native technologist. I'm an operator, strategist, healthcare guy. I'm not a data scientist. I understand the language, but I'm by no means a content expert. And so what do you do when you're an entrepreneur? You find people smarter than you for those things to enhance your skills. And in the early days, my ingoing assumption was, I'll build the operating business, I'll build the strategy, and I'll set the vision. But for the tech piece, I'm going to have to find somebody to give that to me in some way, shape, or form that I will license or use or pay for in some way. I ended up actually investing in a company that had its own proprietary wearable device and claimed to have its own proprietary set of algos. So they had started to build that digital twin vision that Naveen and I had agreed upon years prior. So I invested in that company. I took a seat on its board. I became maybe its second largest or largest shareholder with the intention that my clinic would be one of its customers. Guess what? It didn't work. We opened the clinic. We started using the platform. There was a lot of issues, as with a lot of companies, with what they promised versus what they delivered. But beyond that, beyond the fact that the hardware failed and the algos were not great, we actually came to the realization that the data piece didn't matter as much as we thought it would, and that what actually mattered was the human connection. And so we circled. I actually cut ties with that company, even though I was a shareholder, investor, and board member. I fired them, I guess you could say, and we parted ways. We ended up building a tech stack, which was much simpler, collected the data, but not with a view to build predictive algos, because that didn't move the needle on human behavior. We built a platform that allowed our team to be better versions of themselves. So serving up the information, but not necessarily digesting it or giving any insights, because it doesn't appear to be what actually matters yet, because the algos aren't good enough. I mean, let's say, for argument's sake, and this is what this company had promised. They had promised a library of a dozen and a half algos. You know, one algo would have a relative predicted risk for onset of type 2 diabetes. Another algo for likelihood of developing anxiety disorder or atherosclerosis or depression or high blood pressure. They had individual algos. Remember, we talked about individual system stuff. This was starting to manifest. But when you present that to a patient, all you accomplish is heightened anxiety with zero calibration, because a patient's looking at this and like, hang on, doc, I went from having a 50% risk of an adverse cardiac event to a 60% risk. Is that meaningful? Should I be worried? What is the threshold? what's important, what's not important. Like, it's impossible to calibrate that. We're just not there yet. The data sets aren't big enough. The input variables are not complex enough. The ground truth isn't there. The time hasn't passed. The longitudinal studies haven't been done. So I've actually become an AI cynic, in a sense, where I really believe that a lot of the vast, lofty claims that people are making about the utility of intelligent tools are overpromising. So we've come full circle. We are today rethinking our approach to what tools we actually need to build and what data is important.
It is often said that you learn more from failure than from success, particularly in the early stages of a startup. As Ellie stated, and I quote, "We actually came to the realization that the data piece didn't matter as much as we thought it would, and that what actually mattered was the human connection. We built a platform that allowed our doctors to be better versions of themselves." Wow, that was so cool. Now, while data was undoubtedly valuable, it seems that translating it into predictive algorithms wasn't necessarily, at least not at the beginning, and certainly not to deliver great care. It seems that the real breakthrough was making that data available in an intuitive format that empowered the physicians to better serve their patients and in turn become better versions of themselves. That was the secret sauce. In the future, as data becomes more comprehensive and predictive models improve, this approach might evolve. In fact, Ali's opinion might change. And he said so himself. However, this experience reinforces a key Silicon Valley mantra: solve the problem you have with the simplest technology possible. Don't over-engineer a solution. Or as they say, don't over-index on your engineering. So with that in mind, let's dive deeper and explore a few more of these insightful learning moments that Ali had with this company.
I'll give you another example of like something that's a bit counterintuitive. If you think about the type of data that you want to collect, if your singular mindset is, I want to have the most data to create the best AI, then what are you going to do? You're going to create a platform that captures as much data as it possibly can. But that comes at a cost. So every single platform on the planet has an engagement problem. And I don't want to sound crass, but people who are suffering from diabetes and obesity and metabolic dysfunction, somewhere in the root causes is an engagement problem. So you have to be sensitive to that, and you have to try to optimize for that. And so when you think about food logging, for example, it works for super engaged, motivated people, biohackers, ultramarathoners, people who are like really into calculating stuff. But for the 80-year-old type 2 diabetic, forget it, not happening. So if I'm minded to have the most robust data set, and that's my singular aim, I will fail, because I will ask my patient to log and weigh their food and try to estimate the amount of grams of protein and carbs and da-da-da-da, right? Non-starter. So a little counterintuitively, we didn't ask for that. We just asked for a photo initially. Just take a photo. Whatever you put in your mouth, pull out your phone. You know, some people are already used to Instagramming their food. So for those people, it's a low bar. And for older people, it's a little bit odd, you know, but fine, they got used to it. And it was simple. Just whip it out and take a photo. It doesn't have to be a good photo. Doesn't matter. As long as you capture whatever's in front of you. And part of the problem is that you don't know actually how much of it they've eaten or if they've left out stuff. But anyway, you're getting some record of that event. And that's all that's important because, again, the endpoint is not build the most robust data set. The endpoint is change that human's behavior. How do we do that? I don't need to know how many grams of carbs was in the banana in order to affect behavior change. I just need to have a teachable moment with that patient, whether it's through asynchronous chat on a breezy afternoon where they've just eaten that banana, or it could be after the fact when they come into the clinic for their session with their health coach. At any point, my team, because they're seeing this data come in real time, I see the photo coming in and I see the glucose spike because that data is coming in real time. And I can choose to create a teachable moment right then and there and say, hey, you know, and it's asynchronous chat through the app. It's like, hey, Stefano, let's take a look at your data right now. You just had a banana. Look at your glucose spike. Or I can wait until you come back and I can do a retro on the last 3 months and say, hey, you spiked 10 times out of range. And out of those 10 times, these are the three basic categories of food. And all I have to do is show you the photos. I don't have to tell you how many grams of carbs and how many grams of protein. It doesn't matter. All that matters to change your behavior is to just make that connection in your neurons that you understand cause and effect at a category level. Because we're not dealing with 1/10 of a percentage point improvement in performance on an athlete here. We're dealing with gross level, category level improvements for people who can benefit from very low hanging fruit. So in many senses, the unbridled enthusiasm about data science and AI is false precision. Today, there's much lower hanging fruit with much cruder tools. I shouldn't say cruder, but I should say simpler. So we did come full circle on that. And I think, let me give you another anecdote that, again, I wasn't smart enough to come up with. It was my medical director. My founders and I, we were always very much focused on what's the impact that we're having on our stakeholders, on the insurance companies, on the employers, on the patients. We actually had overlooked the impact that we were having on our own team. They are stakeholders, internal stakeholders. I had never actually sat down, and this is a mistake, something I overlooked. I should have thought about that because that's important. But it came up. One day I was interviewing a new cardiologist, and I had asked our medical director, who was our first physician, Dr. Youssef, to join me in the conversation, in the interview. And we liked her. She was a great candidate. We wanted to give her an offer. Dr. Youssef is German, okay? And so his sense of humor, it's good, it's strong, but it's different because you don't know sometimes whether he's being serious or whether he's telling a joke from looking at his face, okay? And this candidate was Brazilian, which is opposite end of the spectrum from a German, okay? So I'm sitting here watching this interaction between these two physicians. And at the end of the interview, Dr. Youssef, in a very deadpan, dry delivery, told this candidate, he says, listen, I need you to know that if you accept our offer of employment and you come and work for GluCare, you will never leave. Okay? And your listeners can't see my face. Okay? But he said it deadpan, not a break in his smile, nothing. And she's sort of looking at him and then she looks at me and she looks back at him and she says, she's confused, you know, what, is he going to lock me in a dungeon? What's going to happen? So she says, Dr. Youssef, that's a fairly bold statement. What gives you the confidence to say that? And he smiles finally, and he says, well, let me put it this way. Every day that I come to work, I feel like Superman. The platform that Ali and Hassan have built bestow superhuman clinical abilities on me, and that feeling is addictive. And you're going to get addicted to the same thing. And you're never going to find that in any other clinic anywhere. So that for me, I was like, well, we got to put that on the website for sure. You know, like that's got to be our slogan. I mean, these are some things that you serendipitously figure out along the way. We didn't plan for that, but we discovered that and embraced it. And that's important. By the way, let me just caveat that or nuance it, because being superhuman doesn't actually necessarily mean being more intelligent. And let me explain what I mean by that. Being superhuman in the context of the doctor-patient relationship is more about being more human. What are the human attributes that we value? Compassion, empathy, attention, connection. So the superhuman thing that I think Dr. Youssef was referring to was not intelligence. He will, for a long time, be much smarter than any artificial intelligence co-pilot in terms of coming up with a clinical diagnosis. I don't think we're at the point where generalized AI will enhance a specialist's view like him in terms of like coming up with a therapeutic protocol. There's just, I think, too many still variables unaccounted for. But what it does do is take away the noise and the distraction and the time-consuming things that prevent doctors from being human. So he has more time. He has more bandwidth. He has more attention to offer his patients. And he is perceived by his patients to be superhuman. In other words, more compassionate, more empathetic, more connected.
I love that. Superhuman. There are many takes on AI, but usually they focus on what the AI will do, not so much the impact it has. And in general, what AI does is to decrease cognitive load, which in turn enables the clinician to be more focused on the patient because her brain is not processing other tasks like writing a note, ordering medicines, or reviewing a clinical history. So the nice additional step that Ali adds in his conversation, in his thinking, is that freeing up cognitive space allows the doctor to be more human, to have more bandwidth to focus on the patient. I think that's great framing for one of the roles that AI can have in healthcare.
Let's go back to the costing, because you'd mentioned this sounds like a really expensive model. And the next question is, what's the ROI? And is that ROI better than Livongo? Because maybe it's okay that Livongo doesn't deliver as high of an outcome. And candidly, I don't necessarily have to be in existence for 10 years to be able to have an estimation of the ROI, because people have done that work before us, what your ROI equation looks like. By the way, we don't like HbA1c, but it's the lowest common denominator. It's the easiest, cheapest, most ubiquitous measure. Mm-hmm. So our more preferred KPI around glycemic load is time in range. But you can only get time in range if someone's wearing a CGM. And you can only get a CGM if the insurance company is willing to pay for it. There's an ROI calculus just on how much we're willing to spend on a CGM. Time in range is a much better biomarker to look at and track over time. But look, for the purpose of comparative studies, are we better than X, Y, or Z? The only common denominator is HbA1c. When you're talking about other services that we have, like our medicated weight loss program, using the GLPs, then you're looking at not just proportion of body weight lost, but also proportion of muscle mass lost and other markers. So it gets deeper. We have actually quite a rich range of KPIs that we measure just for ourselves. And this is the stuff that we track continuously and we publish against. And so the other measures would be LDL, HDL, BMI is not great, but we track it anyway. Body composition, uric acid levels we track. We have cardiovascular risk scores. So we're constantly trying to improve and enhance our own KPIs.
Fantastic session. Once again, the whole superhuman thing is awesome. So next, let's get into a little bit about investments in digital health in Dubai and that whole region, why it's an interesting place to work and what the business models are.
It's not just interest and investment in digital health. I mean, it started with this, for lack of a better word, let's call it infatuation with the world's greatest brands in healthcare. Across the UAE, Dubai and Abu Dhabi mainly, I've seen partnerships come and go with Harvard, Mayo, Hopkins, Cleveland Clinic, Vamed, Bumrungrad, you name it. Like the best academic centers and operators have been here working hand in hand with the government to build the ecosystem. And I think that's part of the social contract. There's a lot of wealth here. And the rulers of the country are custodians of that wealth for the benefit of the people. And a lot of that gets put into free education, free healthcare, so they can afford it. And, you know, just like you see some of the best cars on the road in healthcare, you see some of the best brands on the walls of the buildings. Most of those partnerships haven't survived. The only one that actually meaningfully has is Cleveland Clinic. They actually built a Cleveland Clinic. And I think that's the differentiator, is that Cleveland was invested in the asset and they operate and they run it and the brand is on the wall. Everything else was more management agreements, which is a little bit lighter touch. And none of those really have survived. That's not digital health. That's just sort of clinical health. On the digital health side, you don't have the same sensitivities around, I don't want to say data privacy, but data sovereignty. And the notion that we have very strongly in the US that my data is my data and the government should never see it, you don't have that as much here, I think. And that's, again, I think kind of goes back to that social contract that the government's providing free care to the locals. And so Abu Dhabi, a few years ago, implemented a program to have regular screening of every UAE national in Abu Dhabi. And if you didn't do that screen, it was called a Wakaya screen, then you would never get your health insurance card. That was the pay to play. To get your benefits, you had to do a blood test and you had to get your screening. And they've amassed over the years an enormous amount of data on the population. Arguably, probably one of the best data sets in the world on a population. So a lot of the data is just sitting there, relatively underutilized. So a lot of the interest in innovating around digital health, digital tools, AI tools, et cetera, is because the fuel to build those tools is there, already built, relatively underutilized. They have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on their genomics data set. I heard, and I'm not sure if this is true, but Abu Dhabi owns more Illumina machines than anyone else because they've just invested in building out a genomic data set on their population that is on par with the world's best and arguably better than the world's best in terms of its breadth of coverage. So I think actually they're coming from a position of, in terms of the data availability at a system and population level, which is super interesting. If you're thinking about doing epidemiological studies, if you're a pharma company, and I would love to see more pharma companies coming and doing clinical trial work on drug development here, because we don't have representative samples from South Asia and from the Middle East and from Africa as an input to an FDA submission. So then there's a massively untapped data market here. So that's one thing. But that's above my pay grade to an extent, because I'm a private entrepreneur. I don't necessarily have access to those things. So there's a lot of innovation and drive that is public sector, government driven. And you have to be careful to sift through the noise, because invariably there will be some noise where announcements are made and some of those announcements will materialize and some won't. What's super interesting about how this economy has evolved is that on some levels, it has handicapped itself by copying the United States and all the flaws therein, because we have a private insurance scheme here which looks most closely like US-style health insurance. But you have pockets of the economy that look a lot more like the NHS or the Canadian system, which is entirely government-funded. And then you've also got, like we mentioned earlier when we were talking offline, this enormously rich, multi-layered demography of both patients and providers from every corner of the planet. You will find a representative set, I would argue, from every country on earth, living here, with an ecosystem here. Gosh, I hired a couple of excellent Brazilian doctors, and it opened my eyes to how massive of a Brazilian community there is here. They have their own ecosystem. They go to their own doctors, and like, you will find that. You'll find a Vietnamese community. You'll find a Korean community. You'll find, obviously, the Emirati community. So if you're someone who's minded towards solving problems across a cross-section of the population, like diabetes, you will get a representative sample of the world in one place. That's super cool and very unique. Now, it's not unique to Dubai, but it's unique enough. There are a few places where that coexists with a regulatory and commercial environment that is conducive to building a startup. That's what's unique. Look, it's a market-driven economy. There are rules. Those rules are generally well understood. No underhanded stuff in dealing with insurance companies and regulators. I mean, it's all above board and very clean and straightforward. We know what the rules are. We know who the stakeholders are. We can engage with those folks. And where there are gaps, there is an openness to those gaps being filled. If there are regulatory or licensing gaps, you can actually work with the regulator and help them upskill and upgrade the ecosystem. And I've done that in some of my own endeavors. So I think there's an opportunity to be participatory in actually building the ecosystem around you where that ecosystem has gaps, which is very cool. And there's a rule of law, obviously. Things are based on contract. And if there's an openness, most people can move to Dubai if they choose to and get a visa here. And look, it's not cheap. So there's a hurdle, which is financial. It's not a cheap place to build a business. There's an expense to moving here and getting a visa and renting an apartment. And, you know, if you're a small startup entrepreneur, it's expensive. It's not the cheapest place to build a team. But again, because it's a hyper-focus area of transit, it's an easy place from which to manage a global team. So you don't necessarily have to build your entire company here. You can have a base here, build your pilots here. My entire tech team is global. I've never met a single one of the guys, but the rest of them are all virtual, all over the world. In a post-COVID world where we have become much more globalized and remote, I think Dubai has become an even more attractive place for people to set up and build a global business. It used to be a place where I would think of it as, okay, you can build a regional business. I built and sold a regional business. And my old business, I didn't really have aspirations of globality at all. I had regional aspirations. In other words, I might build in the UAE, I might build in Saudi, I might build in Kuwait, right, the GCC. But I never had any intention of going to the US. But in the current business, earning the right to win here is a transferable skill set to the US because I'm operating in an insurance environment that looks like the US. By the same token, our elements of the ecosystem here that also allow me to try to tackle the UK. And this is an interesting one. Our next footprint is likely to be in London. So we're working quite actively on that. And that's an interesting market because you've got I think we can all agree, a failing NHS. And that's an ecosystem that kind of looks like the public sector here. But I know that going to London, I will never get a contract with the NHS on day one. I'll have to build towards that over a period of time. The path towards getting there look like the market here because private medical insurance in the UK looks very different generally. It doesn't cover chronic care. PMI in the UK generally covers acute events. The exception is expat plans. Expat plans, global plans will cover chronic care, but local private insurance doesn't. So a diabetes practice in the UK by necessity has to start as a cash out-of-pocket option, which is an interesting way to stress test our model because now we really have to deliver a value proposition to people who are paying out-of-pocket for something. And that value proposition has to be there very concretely. So it's an interesting way for us to stress test our model on the most discerning and sensitive customers. It ends up skewing us towards a higher market segment, which is ideologically not where I want to sit in the long term. We want ubiquitous access to what we've built, because if we in fact have built an engine that is capable of earning the right to win, i.e. producing the best outcome at the lowest unit cost over time, then there's almost a responsibility to make that available to as many people as possible. It's almost like a non-commercial responsibility to do that. And you're not going to do that by building clinics on the high street in London. So my London play is going to be another experiment. And my first foray into the US will be an experiment. My US play is going to look very different than either Dubai or London. It's probably going to be a direct deal with a small pool of employers who own risk because there's no singular US network. There's no US play, right? It's too big of a market to think about it that way. You have to be laser focused and go after something with the highest probability of success. And I think in our domain, that probably is going after a pool of populations where you have identifiable risk that somebody owns and help them mitigate that risk directly.
The idea of stress testing the value proposition by going to a market where your services are not covered is intriguing. You have to be curious to think like that. You have to be willing to take a chance and ask questions about things you don't know the answer to. So clearly, Ali has a deep understanding of the UK market now. He also feels he has earned the right to play in external markets by excelling in his own backyard. And even so, he's cautious. A fair amount of time consulting and speaking with small companies who want to go to the US markets before having tested their products in their own countries. It seldom works. One has to have kind of a deep understanding of how, for example, insurance reimbursement works before tackling new markets, but also how your own product works. And we've been talking about that pretty much this whole conversation. Ali has a great approach to insurers. So listen in.
I want to go back to the cost and ROI thing, because yes, what we do objectively costs more because there's more inputs, there's more FTEs. Each visit that my patients make, it's not a 10-minute thing with a doctor, which is typical. It's 2 hours. It's 30 to 40 minutes with a doctor, 30 minutes with the diabetes educator, 30 minutes with the nutritionist, 30 minutes with the health coach, 30 minutes with the physical trainer. I don't get paid for most of that. So the next question you will have is, well, then how do you make money? What's the commercial model? Because we're operators, we understand the insurance companies well. We understand what they're capable of and what they're not capable of. And part of being an entrepreneur is if you don't ask, you don't get, but also know what you have no chance of getting. Okay, so on individual negotiation basis, we knew we had to be in network. Otherwise, you're just operating as a cash-only option in an insurance-dominated market, which is your debt, right? So we had to be in network with the insurance companies. So while we were building the clinic, we were pitching them to get in network. And it was a high bar because they all had closed networks. Like, no more new providers. So we had to pitch these guys. And the pitch was some version of what the story that we've just discussed. And they're like, okay, great, tech, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, listen, don't worry about that stuff. Don't get distracted. We're just a clinic. Forget about the tech. You don't know how to pay for that. You don't even pay for coaching. You don't even pay for CGMs. So forget that. The things you know how to pay for are four: the doctor visit, the lab tests, the diagnostics, and the drugs. Those four things you guys know how to pay for. And there'll be some proportion of rejections and blah, 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 but generally speaking, it's predictable. You don't know how to pay for tech or data science or wearables or most of my other humans. You won't pay me. If I bill for the time with a wellness coach, it'll get rejected, even if there's a CPT code. You don't know how to pay for remote monitoring, even if there's a CPT code. You'll reject it. I know that. So forget it. I won't even factor that in my calculus. But the things that you do know how to pay for, at least for those things, give me a high enough reimbursement rate relative to the market that I can subsidize the other stuff. That's how we started. And one of the reasons why we built the lab is to make the patient journey magical, like I described earlier. But the other reason is that labs have an incredibly high gross margin. And I use that gross margin excess to quietly cross-subsidize the other stuff. Now, what's interesting is I do all of the stuff that I do, and I still spend less per capita than the other major players in the system. They bill more. The hospital-based providers that have endocrinology practices and blah, 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 they spend and bill more. Two things are happening. One is that I have obviously much tighter control of what's happening. So there's no redundancy in our practice. Never. That's a failure of our practice. But outside, there's tons of redundancy. Duplicative tests, blah, blah, blah. The other thing, and this was interesting, in our first year of operations, we were very curious about one thing. It's like, okay, have we earned the trust of our patients? How do you measure that? One way, indirectly, to measure that, we asked the insurance companies, how many of our patients that came to us subsequently went and billed against a similar billing code at another provider? In other words, second opinions. And I was expecting a number. Do you know what the number was? Zero. None of our patients, once they became our recurring patients, they entirely stopped shopping. So when we think about ROI, on the first pass, the correct gut reaction is, gosh, you guys do a lot of stuff. It must cost a lot more. Yes, within the confines of my four walls, a lot's happening. But because all of that is happening in such an efficient, well-packaged way, we've eliminated a lot of costs that happen out here. So the net cost is on par or cheaper. I don't expect to be driving incremental spend, even though I'm doing incremental activities, because I'm repurposing resources and I'm eliminating a ton of wastage. And that ROI is an easy bit of calculus if you're an insurance company, because you see it. You see the billing. And the insurance companies are not easy to work with on this stuff, right? They don't even know how to do these analytics. It's shocking. So we're working with them to try to frame the math.
Interesting that the conversations with insurers, in his experience, generally focus on costs as opposed to quality. This is probably true in most places. Quality seems to be secondary or poorly defined as a goal or metric in the insurance business.
It never comes up. They don't care. One of the well-renowned global insurance companies, I had the CEO in my office, and he was very interested in developing a program in partnership with us. And I was like, yeah, sure, we'd love to do something. You know, and they brand themselves as an insurance company that really cares. And he was just so focused on his high flyers, the worst controlled diabetics that are just causing all kinds of chaos, billable events, the worst HbA1c's of 14 and that kind of stuff. And I was like, sure, I can definitely help. But I'm actually more interested in creating a widespread pre-diabetes screening program with you and doing a pre-diabetes reversal program, because I have an 80% success rate in pre-diabetes reversal in 3 months. That's our latest published, 79%. So it's a strong pitch. And what's the ROI on that? It's $500,000 in lifetime cost delta. So if you can invest just a few thousand dollars on a pre-diabetes reversal program and keep that patient, gosh, that ROI is 100x. It's a no-brainer. Guess what the answer was? His inside words came out where he bluntly said, oh, I'm not interested in pre-diabetes. And then he caught himself because that's not on brand. And I was surprised, but I was not shocked, because it makes sense, right? I mean, with any business, there's a degree of common sense. Don't ever bet against incentives. Don't ever do that. You will lose. And what do the incentives tell you? It's not hard to read the market in this case. Every insurance contract in this country, because it's regulated this way, is 12 months long. So every employer is renewing their insurance policies every 12 months. There is not a single insurance company that will have any interest in investing a dollar in anything where the ROI has to be measured in greater than 12 months. So what's the ultimate objective? So the long game for us, which you might say, you know, chill out, Ali. It's a little above your pay grade, but hey, you guys got a dream. Our ultimate objective is to actually disrupt how risk is owned and mitigated and paid for. What do I mean by that? Who's mitigating risk today? Nobody, actually. It's just there and we're paying for it. And insurance companies are fine with that because the risks are only getting higher. Metabolic disease is getting worse. Costs are going up. And if you're the CEO of a company whose entire business model is based on taking a haircut of money spent, you're minting. You have no interest in subverting that model. But at a societal level, it's stupid because you'll end up like the US with 20% of GDP on health with arguably bottom decile health outcomes or whatever it is, right? So you want to not get there. Okay, well, then are the insurance companies your partners? They're not. Similarly, our objective is to disrupt insurance for chronic disease, and we will be laser focused on metabolic risk. So ultimately, what I should be selling is not what I'm selling today, which is blood tests and doctor visits and diagnostics and drugs. I'm selling those things because that's all people will buy, fee for service against CPT codes. But what I should be selling, what I want to sell is the outcome itself. I want to get to a point where all of my contracts are with counterparts and entities, i.e. governments, social funds, and employers who own societal risk or organizational risk over a multi-year period and who want to mitigate that risk with a clinical partner who is empowered with the tools to have an effect on that risk. And then I will be their partners, but then I want to get rewarded for that. And so I'll give you an archetypal structure. It's actually one that I proposed to a regional government. I said, look, they invited us to build a clinic in their jurisdiction. I won't say where, because it's still in progress. But I say, look, I'm not in the business of building clinics. That's not who I am. That's not what I do. So I don't want to do that as much as I appreciate the invitation. I'm interested in disruption and I'm interested in finding partners on that journey. Are you willing to have that conversation? And they said, yes. I said, okay, what's your appetite for how wild we can be with this? He says, sky's the limit. Propose something. I said, great. So I went back with the following. I said, I will build 3 clinics in your jurisdiction and I don't want to make any money. So I will bill you at cost, or let's say with a tiny margin just to keep the lights on. And I will be fully transparent on what those costs are. And you can hire a third-party accounting firm to audit that. Open book, down to the paper clips and the toilet paper. You will know exactly what I spend to deliver the care that I deliver. And we will do that. The trade is 2 things. You need to opt in a group of patients who are allocated to us that I will own the risk for that pool, 30,000 patients, whatever. And for that pool of patients, you need to agree to do some analysis on their historical data, which you have. And that analysis will be in the pursuit of a definition of archetypes, because you have that data and that math is easy. And if you're sensitive about giving that data to me, don't give it to me. Hire a third-party actuary, give them the data. And that will allow us to create mathematical predictive models for the evolution of costs of an archetypal patient, i.e. newly diagnosed type 2 that's 40 years old with no comorbidities, pre-diabetic who's 35, 65-year-old with, you know, diabetic foot and retinopathy. So we can create these like categories of archetypes where the archetype has a significant impact on the trajectory of costs over time. And you can model that because you've got very rich data at scale to define that, and you'll have a definable margin of error. So what we can then do is every patient, we can plot them on that curve and we can agree on a baseline the day that we start. This is the baseline because this patient fits this archetype and today they cost $5,000 a year. But because of their archetype, we expect that in 10 years, they're going to develop X, Y, and Z comorbidities and they're actually going to cost $50,000 a year and they're going to die early. And there's a whole calculation of like societal impact, blah, blah, blah. So we would define that ROI calculus, which incorporates productivity losses, it incorporates wastage, it incorporates raw clinical cost, it incorporates whatever. There's some robust ROI calculus that's beyond the fee for service. And then we just do it for 5 years and I'd make no money. But at the end of those 5 years or whatever the agreed term is, and so the pitch is, you know, for whatever agreed time period, 5 years, I don't want to see a dime of profit. But we'll get to a point where we agree to measure the outcome. And the outcome will be very simple. Total cost of care. That's the one measure. And whatever amount that I've reduced the actual total cost of care relative to the predicted cost of care for that population, I want a share of that. You've now objectively saved that money. So it's a win-win. You might agree to give me 50% of that, because otherwise you would have spent it for sure, statistically speaking. That, to me, would be the dream disruption. And I think it's doable. It's not doable everywhere, because you need certain conditions. You need someone who owns an ecosystem, who owns all the costs related to that ecosystem, and where there's no churn. So you need a population where there's local concentration of native individuals who are cared for by a government, for example. You could do this with the NHS. You might be able to do it with a Kaiser. You could do a variant of that with an employer. You'd have to carve out certain things. And the reason I say total cost of care and not diabetes-related care is because we've already beaten our head against the wall trying to get insurance companies to give us estimates of diabetes-related costs. They just can't. And they can't for a simple reason. Coding. Because the coding is flawed. And it just takes too much work to figure it out. You know, a person that comes in with diabetic foot that requires an amputation, that doesn't get coded as a diabetic complication. It gets coded as an orthopedic procedure. And so it gets missed. Inherently, a model like ours is more difficult to scale than a purely digital model, but it's not impossible. It just takes a little bit more time. And that's okay, because we're playing the long game.
I've heard this type of model referred to as going at risk. Essentially, if I go at risk with you, I only get paid if I save you money. The only viable partner for such a model is someone who owns the risk. And I can only go at risk if I control all the cost drivers, something we identified as a weak point for purely digital models that don't account for analog or in-person cost inputs. On the flip side, once validated, digital models tend to scale more effectively than hybrid ones. Both sides of the same coin. And with that, we bring this interview to a close. We covered a lot of ground, from the importance of patient-centric healthcare models to the value of integrating digital tools with human care in hybrid models. We explored the critical role of patient engagement in driving success, the importance of aligning technology with specific needs, and how to navigate the healthcare ecosystem in Dubai. We also delved into strategies for calculating ROI, building risk-based care models, and engaging with payers. I thought it was a fantastic interview. And finally, as with all the innovators featured in this series, you've heard Ali's vision and curiosity. Curious minds challenge the status quo, craft alternative solutions to chronic problems like chronic diseases, and think out of the box. With that, I am Dr. Stefano Bini, the Maria Menitti Schrem Endowed Professor at the University of California, San Francisco, Department of Orthopedics. Thank you for listening, and I leave you with a challenge. Stay curious. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I will reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.